I want to talk a little bit about grief. This is obviously not a seminar on grief, which is something that could be done, but I just want to remind you of some basic things about it. But what I want you to understand is that victims of abuse or any kind of trauma need to grieve, because it always means loss, always. For many, it's loss of their entire childhood and all the things that some of us remember as nice things about being a child that they never had and whatever. It means loss in terms of what they know about God, and they just feel like they're playing catch-up for the rest of their lives and the self they would have been if they'd never been abused and so forth. I also find that survivors are terrified to grieve. There is tremendous resistance to it. And they say things like, if I start crying, I'll never stop. Or they say, it's a black hole and nobody will ever find me again. So it feels infinite to them. And first of all, you can't push them to grieve. You can't make somebody grieve, obviously. But your relationship with them becomes extremely crucial at that point, because you're going to go in the black hole with them, which changes the nature of the black hole. And you bring light to them, which they've already experienced, because this is one of the later things in therapy. You bring light to them. You're going to bring that light into the black hole, because you're going to have enough light to see them, to be with them, to hear them. So they tend to interpret grieving and tears the way they thought about them as a child, which means nobody's here, nobody will find me, nobody cares, and it's really, really black, and if I go there, I'll die. So that's what they expect. So you work with them for a while to sort of structure it so that they include you in their thinking about crying or grieving. Now, nobody wants to grieve, no matter why or whatever it's for. It's very painful. It's something we do, all of us. Nobody escapes it. And it's something we do multiple times in our lives. So it's just important to have some understanding of it. And the Bible has a lot to say about grief, which I find interesting, because things that survivors struggle with, like faith, anger, grief, are often the things that the church community pushes back on and says, basically, you shouldn't be like that. Somehow grieving or having anger about what happened to you says bad things about God, which hopefully by the time we finish, you'll see isn't true. And so you not only have people who are resistant to grieving and to weeping, but you have people who have been hearing things that are not true from the scriptures. So sometimes you have to do a little teaching as you go along. You think about, you know, Jeremiah 31, a voice is heard in Ramah, mourning and great weeping, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because her children are no more. That probably wouldn't go over very well in most of our churches. Hannah grieving her infertility speaks of pouring out her anguish and grief. Jeremiah again, my eyes fail from weeping. I am in torment within. My heart is poured out on the ground because my people, or because I am destroyed. Lamentations is devoted to grief. We don't hear a lot of sermons on Lamentations. So the people of God grieve. There are plenty of reasons in this world for us to grieve. If you're going to do this work, you're going to grieve, and you better learn how to do it and make room for it. Jesus obviously grieved, and he wept, and of course that's part of what I help them see. You know, that they're entering again into something that he has entered into with them and will do with them. And it goes through, I'm sure many of you have studied grief or whatever, you know, it goes through the typical stages, you know, as you walk through therapy with somebody. You know, they do the shock denial thing. It wasn't a big deal. It really didn't happen. It didn't hurt me very much. I should be over it by now. It happened 15 years ago. I don't know what's the matter with me. All of those kinds of things that go into that. the whole numbness that people do. You know, if you've ever lost somebody that you love, you know, you have places where you just sort of sit around and stare, and then an hour later you sort of come to, and you have no idea that you were even thinking anything. You're just kind of blank. Well, survivors do the same kind of thing. And in some ways that blankness is helpful because it's like an oasis. You know, you're not wrestling with how could this really be true? I can't live without this. All those things that we do when we grieve the loss of somebody, when you go into that blank state, it's a little bit of a reprieve, and then you come to again and you have no idea what your mind was doing, and then it washes over you again. So it's also very typical of survivors. Grieving involves the body. You've ever been with somebody who was convulsively sobbing as they were grieving or whatever. And so you have to help survivors see that. You know, people feel like they can't breathe, or they have chest pains, or they have a racing heart, or they can't think, or they can't function, and all of those things are very common. Anger is a part of grief. A lot of survivors are very afraid of their own anger. And I will usually work with them as much as possible to find physical expressions that are safe and legal for their anger. Because it is such a physical emotion. But it is part of grieving. Because when you start grieving these huge losses in childhood, you also get really mad at the people who took those things away from you. So it goes together. And it's important for them to understand that. There are survivors who prefer the anger to the grief because they feel more alive and stronger when they're angry. Grieving makes people feel little and swallowed up and things like that. So some will want to stay angry and not go to grief. And there's always a place in the grief process where hope is gone. It's just black. And it feels like you'll never get over it and you'll never be the same. And, you know, that's when your relationship with them is very important, because I know that you don't have any hope. I have hope for you. Piggyback on mine. You know, when you say there's no hope, remind yourself, well, Diane's crazy enough to have some. Just hold on to mine. I'll do it for you. I had a survivor many years ago that I said that to, and she went home and put little sticky notes around her house. Diane has hope, Diane has hope, everywhere. And she was in a pretty black place. I was a little worried about her at that point. Anyway, a pastor came by the house. And he said, what's that? So she told him, and he said, you need to take them down. Your hope is in God. Didn't understand. I mean, he was a good man. I mean, he wasn't, you know, but it was, we had some repair work to do after that. You know, it's just so interesting to me how often, and this work teaches you over and over again, how often we miss the incarnational piece. It's got to be fleshed out for us to get it. That's why he came. That's why he said, I'm bread and water and vines and everything else. So Diane has hope. Do I want her hope to be in me? Heaven forbid. But I can take her by the hand and get her someplace else while I have hope and she doesn't. So you can't miss that piece. And then as you come toward the end of grief, you know, you come to the new beginnings, little by little. Somebody sort of looks up and has 10 minutes where they're not grieving and goes, oh, this is different. And little by little, that builds. It involves survivors admitting the losses, naming the losses, which is very painful for them to do and something they want to avoid. But it need, you know, they want to reject them because in many cases they're massive, just massive. They need to express the emotions and the thoughts. They need to find a way to say goodbye. Oftentimes it involves something, you know, somebody will plant a tree or bury something or put something in the ocean or, you know, all different things that people come up with. But they need to find a way to say goodbye to the child that didn't get to be. And they have to be obviously in a place where grief is somewhat resolved, because you want them to have hope for the person they are becoming because of God's work in their life. So they have to have both sides. But they do need to find a way to memorialize the child that survived, that didn't go insane, that's actually an adult with a functional life at this point, but also grieve the child that never was. So it's a combination of honoring the child and grieving the child as they say goodbye. You become the comforter in this process. Walter Wongren says this to comforters: always take your cues from her. By instinct, she is leading; in patience, you are serving. So the griever is the one, just like we've talked about in the whole situation, the dynamic here, you don't teach, you listen. You read and reassure. You read and ask if what you're reading is correct. It's not a time of instruction, it's a time of being with. You need to expect anger and not be surprised by its intensity. And you're going to get some of it because you're safe. It's actually a compliment in some weird sort of way. The role of comforter is exposing. You know, if you have things in your life that haven't grieved, it's going to poke at you. If you have losses, you have deaths that you haven't accepted or dealt with, it'll bring that stuff up in you. And you have to be very aware of those things in yourself, because you will stop the work if you're not careful. So you need to not do your work with the patient, because they're the patient, you're not. But you do need to be aware and have some place that you go with the things that it kicks up in you, so that you do your own work so you don't infect the process. The other thing that I think therapists struggle with is being overwhelmed by the level of grief, the number of losses, just the extent of the damage in some of these lives. So again, you've got this grown-up in front of you who's functional, and you've watched have great courage and face things and learn new skills and all those things, but both of you are confronted with the losses, and it can be overwhelming. And so you have to walk through the valley with him or her, but you also have to remember this is not your valley. You have your own. This is their valley that you're walking through with them. You become a servant to the griever, and you have to take care of yourself, which we will talk about more in the last session. Now, one of the things that we make a mistake about, certainly in the church at large, but also I think in counseling, is that we want people who are grieving to express their grief, but now it's time to move on. Part of it is because we are uncomfortable with it, and sometimes that is because we haven't dealt with some of our own losses. We want it to be short, we want it to be neat, and we don't want it to be too emotionally intense because it makes us nervous. So we're often trying to fence it. We want to answer their questions. Grief is full of questions. Nobody wants answers when they're grieving. They aren't going to hear them anyway. So I think we often treat grievers in the Christian world as if they're doing something wrong. And we have these ideas, you know, you should grieve this amount of time. So you lose your spouse in a year, you should be better. Well, that's ridiculous. And anybody who studied grief knows that that's ridiculous. But so it's just not allowed. And we read it in the Christian community as a lack of faith. You're still grieving? Where's your hope in God? So the Book of Psalms has a type of song we call a lament, which is something the church has lost in many ways. In a lament, people pour out their complaints against God. How many times do you hear that in the church? And their grief over their losses, and seek him to act on their behalf. So, for example, Psalm 13:1, how long, O Lord, are you going to forget me forever? Laments encourage people to be honest with God about the emotions that in the Christian world we're often uncomfortable with. So anger, questioning God, grief, doubting. Laments do not try to solve the problem. They're simply ways of being honest with God about what they are feeling and thinking. So it's interesting to read some of these Psalms, 3, 4, 5, 6. Psalm 11, 13, 16, 17, 22, and just to think about them in the context of the work that you do. They express feelings that many people of faith would say show a lack of faith. But they're scripture. And the laments are to God. They're talking to him. Faith is being demonstrated. You talk to a God you can't see, you've got some faith going on there, right? So it's being demonstrated by somebody in great pain. So I have brought a lament today that I have used all around the world. This is a version of it. So when we do it, keep in mind that there are people in Rwanda with genocide scars on their skulls who say this same thing. And people in Romania whose parents lived through Ceausescu who say the same thing. And people who've been trafficked. All sorts of things. So I'm going to have us do it together like a choral reading. So you can see what a lament feels like. Now, some of you today are probably grieving, given the numbers. And so for some of you, it may be a little difficult. If it is, just listen. That's okay. And for some of you, may be grieving, and it'll give you some words. So if you feel you can't participate, that's fine. But as we do this, this is not just about teaching your clients to lament. You cannot do this work and not lament. Something inside you will get twisted and die if you don't lament. You know, I drive home sometimes banging on the steering wheel saying, "What are you doing, God? Where are you?" That's lament. So as you do this, keep in mind that you're going to need to do this many times as you work with people, not just with sexual abuse. You're going to work with addicts and eating disorders and marriages falling the heck apart and kids who are completely messed up and people who go to prison and whatever. We work with ruination. It requires lament. So again, it's a tool for you as well. It is also a very powerful tool for survivors. And one of the things I have done is give them a very short version of some of this. And then I say, go look in the scriptures, look in the Psalms, look in Jeremiah, look in Lamentations. Write your own. Write your own. So they come back with something. Sometimes I say, particularly people who are gifted writing or whatever, read the ones in the scripture, put the book away, now write your own. And they come up with their own. It's just profound, powerful pieces. And they come out of the heart, and the whole person is connected, which is a new thing for somebody who's been all chopped up in pieces by abuse. So many, during a season of grieving, will take a lament or several and use them as part of their devotional daily while they're grieving. And again, they are showing faith in God, and they are speaking to him out of the depths of their soul about their losses and fears and angers and pain. So what I'm going to ask you to do is stand up, and you'll see it says who to read. So sometimes it's me, sometimes it's everybody, sometimes it's the men, sometimes it's the women. And we'll just... Well, come up closer. Feel free to come up if you can't see it. Okay, so maybe the first couple rows need to sit down. I don't really know how to do that all the way back. Find a place where you can see. Okay, you ready? Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble?
My God,
why have you forsaken me?
My eyes so far forsaken me. From the words of my groaning, O Lord my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night I find your rest.
How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day?
Our eyes failed, ever watching vainly for help. You have wrapped yourself with a cloud, so that no prayer can pass through. You have made us so among the peoples.
All our enemies open their mouths against us. Panic and pitfall have come upon us. Devastation and destruction. My eyes flow with rivers of tears. I have been hunted like a bird by those who were my enemies without cause. They flung me alive into the pit and cast stones on me. Water closed over my head. I said, I am lost. Therefore, I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul.
There is no faithfulness or steadfast love,
and no knowledge of God.
There is swearing and lying, and murder and stealing,
and committing adultery.
Let them break all bounds, and blood shall follow its bloodshed. Therefore, the man mourns, and all who dwell in my language.
Therefore, I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. So I am allotted months of emptiness, and nights of misery are apportioned to me. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise? But the night is long, and I am full of tossing till the dawn. My flesh is clothed with worms and dirt. My skin hardens, then breaks out afresh. Therefore, I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. I loathe my life. I will give free utterance to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul, and I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend against me. Does it seem good to you to oppress, to despise the work of your hands and favor the designs of the wicked? Why did you bring me out of the womb? Would that I had died before any eye had seen me and were as though I had not been carried from the womb to the grave. Are not my days few? Then cease, leave me alone, that I might find a little cheer before I go and I shall not return. To the land of darkness and deep shadow, the land of gloom like thick darkness, like deep shadow without any order, where light is as thick darkness. Therefore, I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. My eyes flow without ceasing, without respite, until the Lord from heaven looks down and sees. Remember, O Lord, what has befallen us. Look and see our disgrace.
My soul also is greatly troubled. But to you, O Lord, how long? Turn, O Lord, and deliver my life. Save me from the sake of your steadfast love.
Remember, O Lord, what has befallen us. Look and see our disgrace. Why do you forget us forever? Why do you forsake us for so many days? Restore us to yourself, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days as of old. Remember, O Lord, what has befallen us. Look and see our disgrace. In my distress, I called upon the Lord. To my God, I cried for help.
Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry.
Hold not your peace at my tears. Hear my prayer, O Lord. Let my cry come to you. Do not hide your face from me in the day of my distress. Incline your ear to me. Answer me speedily in the day when I call.
Hear, O Lord, when I cry aloud. Be gracious to me and answer me. You have said, seek my face. My heart says to you, your face, Lord, do I seek. Hide not your face from me. Turn not your servant away in anger. O you who have been my help, cast me not off, forsake me not, O God of my salvation.
Hear my prayer, O Lord. Hear my prayer, O Lord. Hear my prayer, O Lord. You think about some of those words and somebody who was repeatedly abused as a child. One of the things, obviously, that it does is free them up to speak to God the truth, which they never got to say growing up, about what's going on inside of them, about the damage that has been done, and to be safe in doing so. So it often has a remarkable impact. Sometimes clients will either write or use part of this lament or something and want me to do it with them in the session, which is fine. Sometimes they just want to come and do what they have written. Sometimes they tend to be more private about it and just want me to read what they've written, not do it out loud. But the idea for somebody who's been incubated in lies and evil, that they can speak the truth to God, which is a demonstration of faith in God, about all the things they thought you're not allowed to say to God, and still be safe, is just a really remarkable and often radical experience for many of them. And so I find it to be an extremely helpful tool. The other thing that it does, you know, when you're a little child, a boy or girl, who's being repeatedly abused, what you pretty much believe growing up is you're the only one. Because it's isolating. First of all, it's done in secret usually and all those kinds of things. And you may have a sibling who's abused or something, but pretty much you think if something's the matter with you and nobody else would understand or anything else. Part of what these scriptures do is show victims that there are hundreds of years of human history where people have talked to God with the same feelings and complaints and anger and grief that they have. And it I don't know what it does. It does something. It opens their eyes to something. And to the fact that not everybody had the same experience they had in terms of what was done to them. But many people have had the same internal experience from the damage that they had done in various ways. And that God's people wrote these words. They are in the scriptures. They are quoting the Bible when they say the things they're most afraid to say to God himself. So I find it extremely beneficial to them, comforting to them, changes the way they think about God and their feelings, and gives them hope, which of course eventually leads them out of grief. I've also had clients who, you know, we talked about how they have to say goodbye, and so they learn ways to memorialize something about their childhood or whatever. I've had clients who, whatever that is that they've done, they will often go back every year to that place, and they will lament. You know, it's like it becomes a discipline in their lives. Just to remember, you know, even if they've grown way beyond all of those symptoms and everything else, but to remember the child and the damage, and be able to speak to that in the form of a lament, and then go back to doing life again. So there are sometimes people who find that sort of thing very helpful.